May it please the Court, good morning, Your Honors. Assistant Federal Defender Daniel Broderick on behalf of Doc McNeely, Petitioner.
Good morning.
The respondent has conceded in the brief that there is presumptive prejudice. Under Doggett, Supreme Court opinion in Doggett, what that means is that the respondent must now rebut the presumptive prejudice persuasively. They haven't done any of that.
By the way, what's the current status of the state court case?
It's still pending. He still hasn't had a trial.
So he's still in pretrial detention?
Yes.
What is it, 5 years now?
I'm sorry?
5 years now? Or
it's been 5 years, yes.
5 years
well,
of pretrial?
Well, 5 years, I think, in April.
Has there been a...
He's, I think, and I apologize, Your Honor, I tried to contact his current trial counsel. He's been out sick. But from the last I heard, and what I heard from his secretary, is that he's back in Atascadero because he was sitting in Sacramento County Jail. So,
has there been a, preliminary hearing? Or?
No, never been a preliminary hearing.
And is he in a competent status right now, or has he been deemed incompetent at this point?
I apologize, Your Honor. I just don't know the latest. When I last talked in December, he had made a request to be removed back to Atascadero because the facility was easier for him than staying in Sacramento County Jail. And I don't know the status of his of that. I don't know the answer to your question, Your Honor. I apologize.
Atascadero is a psychiatric facility.
Well, that's where he was before. That's where he was before, and that's.
Doesn't indicate there's some,
I don't think
there are mental problems. There are mental problems, right?
Yes, but I don't think there's anything happening at Atascadero right now. He's not there to, as far as I understand, to return him to competency.
Well, is there a current finding of competency? Or you're not sure of that?
I don't know, Your Honor.
All right.
I just simply don't know that.
Go ahead.
Can I ask you this one more question? If he were convicted of the crime, now is there an indictment or an information or a complaint? Information. If he were convicted of the crime charged in the information, what would be the maximum sentence?
Well, it would all depend.
It's a second strike case?
Yes, it's a second strike case in a sex offense case in which frequently all of the counts are run consecutively with an additional strike. So... I'm just hazarding a guess that it's well in excess of 50 years, would be my guess. But in his particular case, this is the difficulty with respondents' position, is that they have to address the factors in his case. And that's why we highlighted, it's actually at page 55 of the excerpt of record, is his actual information. And this is not an information in which it says, on one specific date, one specific act happened. It's a 4.5 month period 5 years ago. And even the last two charges, the failure to register charges, are not just failure to register. They're failure to register within 5 days. Failure to register within 5 days. So they have to show that he can remember exactly what he was doing every day of a 4.5 month period, 4.5 years ago, 5 years ago.
What you're arguing now is that you're arguing prejudice, right?
I'm arguing prejudice. And he has indicated in under oath in his petition, it's at ER 7, that his memory has been impaired, that his memory due to the taking of psychotropic drugs has now been impaired with respect to the events at issue in the information. So we believe that the respondent has utterly failed or even attempted to assume the mantle of rebutting persuasively the prejudice. Now, another issue in this case that we didn't raise directly in the brief, but the respondent argues that he repeatedly waived time and that he was repeatedly found incompetent. You can't have it both ways. Any waiver of time by Mr. McNeely has to be knowing and intelligently made. So to say that Mr. McNeely, which they haven't proved with any transcripts, that Mr. McNeely knowingly and intelligently waived time, at the same time they're saying, well, he was necessarily incompetent.
Now, how many lawyers has he had during this period of time?
At the time, I think, of his habeas being filed, I think it was four. He's now had the same lawyer, so I think he's at five. He's had the same lawyer he's had since the time of his habeas to now. It's a deputy public defender. And, Your Honor, with respect to that, I just want to address one thing. It is exceptionally rare, for a defense attorney to say, I think my lawyer's incompetent, even when psychologists say he's not.
The client, yeah.
My client is incompetent, and he has nothing. There's nothing in the record to support that, except the clock was ticking.
Except what?
Except the clock was ticking. It was getting awfully close to when he had to put on some case. And there was nothing in there to indicate that.
What about the prosecution's motion to dismiss? And then, as I guess under California law, the prosecution, if you're running up against this delay, the prosecutor can dismiss the case and then refile the same case, and it starts the clock all over again?
That's my understanding. Start the statutory clock all over
again. Statutory clock.
It doesn't start the constitutional clock. The difficulty, as we highlighted, well, one of the difficulties, even though it's not an actual claim here, the difficulty is that when they do that, he's supposed to be released.
Yeah.
He wasn't released. They dismissed it. Refiled it the next day, and he stayed in custody the whole time.
He was held overnight until the new filing was made, but, of course, as you say, that's not before us.
They didn't follow the law in that respect. This is, and I'll actually try to save some time for rebuttal, this is not a garden variety competency case. This is not a case of someone seeing little green men. This is not a case of someone babbling incoherently. This is a case, as the magistrate judge found, where he just disagreed with his lawyers. And not surprisingly, he disagreed with the lawyers who thought he was incompetent.
Well, speaking of disagreeing with his lawyers, I mean, you do agree that at least a substantial portion of the delay is attributable to him, or him meaning the petitioner here, or to his competency problem.
Correct. And that's why what I tried to do in my opening brief was put an asterisk besides those time periods that are not attributable to what Your Honor just said. And that I totaled those days to be over 367 days.
Well,
that are simply not attributable to him at all.
Part of the problem, you know, is this is one of the worst state court records I've seen. I mean, you almost can't tell what this gibberish means. It's very difficult.
Well, and I should indicate one thing in that regard, Your Honor, and then I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal. On page 88 of the excerpt of record is the magistrate judge's findings and recommendations. And the footnote of that says that on October 16th, the year 2000, the respondent was ordered by the magistrate judge to submit any and all transcripts relevant to a determination of the issues in the petition. So if there's any concern about the record being incomplete, it all relies on respondent's feet. I'd like to reserve the rest of time.
All right, fine. Thank you, Mr. Broderick.
Good morning, Your Honors. Craig Myers for respondent. The district court in this case correctly found that no speedy trial violation occurred applying the four-part test of Barker versus Wingo. Before I get into my argument, I would like to address what my belief is for the status.
How can you make that finding when it's almost impossible to understand this, you know, the record, or what all these little notations mean and who's responsible for what? Now, this is – it's your obligation under the habeas rules to bring up a record, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you didn't do that.
Well, I would submit that I did. The minute order –
Maybe you did the best you could, but it's not much of a record. Well, why didn't you order transcripts?
Some transcripts were ordered.
Why didn't you order them all?
In this case –
That's your obligation, isn't it?
It is my obligation. I personally is not.
You know, it's hard to understand what's going on here without those, because you get these, you know, these cryptic so-called minutes or whatever they are, and who knows what happened? I mean, you know, in that situation, I think you have the obligation to order a transcript, which you did not do.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Nor did you respond to the petitioner's request for transcripts. Why didn't you do that?
Well, some transcripts were sought and some were requested. However, the district court did not have any trouble finding that the minute orders reflecting the PT 1060, which is personal time waiver, 10 and 60 days, was adequate and sufficient. And those findings now are on a clear error standard.
Right.
And respondent submits that all the minute orders do reflect in the.
But it's a matter of law that it's your burden of proving what these things mean.
That's correct. And
we reviewed that de novo.
Excuse me?
We reviewed that de novo. It's a legal question whether you met your burden.
That's correct. But the district court, in finding that the record was sufficient, is reviewed on clear error. And in responding to the reply brief, appellant claims that there's on excerpt of record 43 on 8/28 of 98, it indicates that there's a PTW, personal time waiver, 10/60. He claims that the transcript, which is in the file, in the excerpt of record at page 66 through 67, does not jive. That's completely incorrect.
Turning you to also make the argument that the SC notations mean that that was at McNeely's request to pursue plea negotiations, and you say that's a time extension that or delay that he's responsible for. But I don't see how you can extrapolate that, because normally SC means status conference.
It means status conference, and we did put in a footnote that was conjecture on our part of how trials are normally done in Sacramento, that it was put over status conference for plea negotiations.
Right. Well, so how does that go toward meeting your burden?
Meeting my burden in what respect?
The conjecture that the status conference was a notation that meant it was being put over for plea conferences, plea agreement conferences, in which the court doesn't participate anyway.
It's the it's our position that the minute orders indicating that it was put over for SC, which stands for status conference, and the district court found that to be that the notation was correct and the record was adequate in that respect. If I can get back to the alleged inconsistency that petitioner is claiming on excerpt of record page 66 or 67, which there is a transcript, he's claiming that somehow he did not waive time. But a reading is clearly the court does indicate that his attorney had requested a date to be set for October 2nd, and the judge said, we're going to set a prelim at that date. He says, time waived, Mr. McNeely, until then. I'm in agreement, Your Honor. The court goes on to say, all right, you understand you would be entitled to a prelim within 10 days of the entry of plea or 60 days of that date. Mr. McNeely says, thank you very much, Your Honor. The court says, thank you. That's a clearly indication of the transcript that a 10- to 60-day time waiver was personally elicited knowingly from defendant, and then it's reflected on the minute order. To respond to counsel's argument that sometimes he was competent, sometimes he was incompetent, so how could he make a knowing time waiver, there was various points when he was found to be competent. There are other times when he was found by his lawyers or indicated by his lawyers that he was incompetent, and that's actually the bulk of the delay, is the competency proceedings. And he was found to be incompetent several times and spent years in a Tuscadero. I'd also like to note that the filing of this case here has attributed greatly to the delay.
How is that?
The last indication that we have is on excerpts of record 33, that a jury trial was set on McNeely's competency for February 14, 2001, is currently pending. That's when this case took effect, and we've been briefing this case, getting the decision of the magistrate judge, district court, and then in front of this court now.
But I still don't understand how filing this petition contributes to the delay in the state trial court.
They suspended proceedings.
Why?
Apparently.
Who's they?
Pardon me?
Who's they?
State court judge, or the request of the DA? I mean, why?
I believe it was the state court which suspended proceedings because the competency proceedings were set for jury trial.
But why? What's the reason that was given?
That I'm not certain of.
Well, then how can you attribute it to the filing of the habeas petition? I don't see a connection, frankly.
Okay. There was also several delays that were attributed to defendant in disqualifying the trial judge three times when it was currently set to head to jury trial.
How much of the 5 years in the state's view is not attributable either to, you know, actions by the defendant, petitioner, or attributable to problems involving his competency?
The problems attributed to his competency come out to approximately 2 years. The petitioner claims that when the case was refiled on August 11th.
Well, finish answering my question. So you get 2 years to competency, and how much of the rest of the?
Then we have several times where there's been personal time waivers taken by petitioner was approximately 7 months. There was also 6 margin motions, 5 attorneys. Each time an attorney came in, he needed time to prepare, and while there was that time could be attributed.
How much is that total?
The
or don't you know?
No, it's listed in my brief. I believe when I calculated that point out, that time for the attorneys to come and prepare was approximately 1 year. Honestly, it's hard to determine because an attorney comes in, there's time waivers, they're seeking more time, there's continuance, there's waiving of the prelim.
What's your argument on prejudice, assuming we reach that issue? According to Mr. Broderick, that's really the only issue we have to decide.
On the issue of prejudice, respondent's position is that none has been shown by petitioner. In fact, the prejudice is more likely to the people. This is a child molest case, and getting back to petitioner's argument that there's very scant information in the information itself, it's a child molest case. It took place on a child under 14. In all likelihood, she's going to be more reluctant or less willing or unable to testify in this case.
But do you really know that? You don't even know which way. When was the last time you contacted the victim in this case?
I have never contacted the victim
in this case. When was the last time the trial counsel contacted the victim in this case?
I don't know that.
I mean, it seems to me that, well, if you go, okay, when was the habeas filed?
This habeas was filed on June 21st of 2000, okay. 26 months after the original complaint was filed.
And so a year and a half ago, almost
That's
2 years, right? And nothing's happened, and this man's still in pretrial detention?
Well, there was activity going on from when the habeas was filed, because the last date that we have in the record was that a jury on his competence proceeding was set for February 14, 2001, and that had been after the case had been set for trial, and Mr. McNeely had disqualified 3 trial judges.
What's your understanding of the current status of the case in state court?
The current status is that it's pending. Just pending on his competency.
Is there a ruling by the state court postponing it while we decide this case?
Not that I'm aware of.
So it's just out there in a kind of state limbo.
Actually, yes, it is. It's out there in limbo, and in my view, it would be pending the outcome of this case.
Could I ask you about the footnote on page 88, the excerpt that was referred to by counsel for the... That describes the orders and the transcripts you were provided. Are you in a position to provide any more transcripts than you did under those orders?
Currently, no, I'm not. I'm not in a position.
I'll tell you frankly, one possible solution would be to remand this to the district court to get more information, but if you can't provide any more information, there's no point in doing that.
I'm not saying that I can't provide them. I'm not in a position
well,
to provide them now. And if order to, I will.
But you did try to comply with the magistrate's orders. How are you going to have more than you came up with then?
I was not the attorney at that time in this case. I don't know exactly what efforts were taken.
May we assume that the estate did its best to comply?
Yes, I would assume so. I know the deputy
handled
it. That's
why the idea of remanding seems sort of futile.
Well, I think you have to answer this question carefully. Now, you think a remand to, obtain a fuller picture of the state court proceedings, more state court records would be futile?
No, I do not. I believe that if this court and if the district court needs to receive all the transcripts, I will endeavor my best to get them. And then if I can't, we can proceed on the current record.
What you're saying, well, first of all, you're saying you're not the attorney who responded to that footnote or those, right?
That's correct.
Number two, maybe you have no more records in your file cabinet in your office, but you're not certain what you might get by contacting the state, either the state trial court or the DA, right?
That's correct.
All right.
I'm not certain of what records I can get.
Well, but the burden on you was to satisfy, to show that there was, you weren't responsible. And if the state failed to do that, why do we give you another chance?
Well, our position has been that the record does indicate that there was personal time waivers, that there was competency proceedings.
Well, I think we all thought there are gaps that are inexplicable.
Up to the point when the last state court proceeding on February 14th, there are a few gaps, but they're, 5-10 days here and there.
Those things add up.
They do, but at each point, then the next court time, there's a personal time waiver, there's a Marsden motion, there's a disqualification of a trial judge, there's a new attorney, and the proceedings start over again. And
well, let's take the big gap now that this whole proceeding has been held up. If there wasn't any order, can we say that it was the fault of the petitioner that he brought a habeas case and thereby brought the state to drop the ball?
No.
I mean, if the state didn't get an order delaying it for some good reason, you've wasted a couple of years in trying it.
Unfortunately, I'm not in a position to answer that question because...
Oh, why don't you try to devise an answer?
Of why, when the last court date of the 14th until currently what's been happening?
Yes.
That I can't answer. It's always been my understanding that the state court has suspended proceedings pending the outcome of this case.
That seems to me that's quite perverse, But I understand you're not responsible. All right, so you're way over your time. I think we understand your position. We appreciate your argument. But I'll just say, this is one of the... to think that in the state of California, a person is in pretrial detention for 5 years is, it's something nobody wants to believe. Is it? Is it common?
No, it's not common, but this is not the common defendant. This is not the common case. So I am out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, rebuttal.
Just a few brief points in no particular order, Your Honors. Counsel indicated that some of the delay was to get new counsel up to speed. In fact, the supplemental excerpts of record, counsel identified it as section 58-122. Page 10, there's actually a declaration from one of those counsel that indicates the entire record relating to these charges in discovery is 50 pages, 50 to 60 pages. That's it. That's all it is. So we're not talking about mountains of discovery.
Are you aware of any order regarding the pendency of the habeas petition?
An order from the federal court?
The state court.
I'm not, Your Honor, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. I'm just not aware of any. I have talked to his counsel, his defense counsel, and he didn't indicate to me in my two or three conversations before that there was anything that was holding it up. There's also, with respect to Your Honor's concerns, and I agree that there is always the possibility of a remand. I would strongly object, one, for the fact where I already indicated that they got their not only got their bite at the apple, they were specifically instructed to take that bite of the apple. It's just, under the facts of Mr. McNeely's case, not only do I think it's unfair to him, but what we're looking at is, at best, if we had an order, respondents would have to go to state court. They'd have to say, we need transcripts prepared for 50 hearings. They're going to have a request for that continuance. They're going to have any, and we're back here 3 years later, and he's still in jail. The last thing is simply with respect to clear error or the judge's findings. The district court judge in this case made it absolutely clear in his findings that he was simply adopting the facts as alleged by respondent. There really was no factual finding. He says in his order specifically, I am adopting the facts as alleged by them. And right off the bat, What he said was, what the respondent said was, there were all these continuance for plea negotiation conferences, and there's nothing in the record to support that. So on that, I'll submit it. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Broderick. Thank you, Mr. Myers. This case is submitted for decision.